And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a bicyclist was injured by a booby trap set in southeast Portland.
CNN is suing Trump and other top White House aides.
And in international news, Israel and Palestine have announced a ceasefire following intense fighting earlier today.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 13th, 2018. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. A Portland woman was injured Friday after bicycling through a booby trap of thin woven string tied across the I-205 multi-use path. Carlene Ostergaard was biking near Southeast Division Street around 10:30 p.m. when she crashed into the web of twine. She suffered injuries to her face and neck. Ostergaard said, quote, "I could actually feel the pieces unraveling across my face. I was crying. It was like this feeling of sadness and despair that human beings would do this." Ostergaard said that before the crash, she saw three men run up the hill away from her and stop behind a retaining wall to watch. That's when she says she hit the trap. Ostergaard added, quote, "Between the time that I actually made sense of what had happened to me, stopped, made the decision to call the police, and the police showed up, it was likely 15 minutes, and the suspect stayed, which is confusing." Law enforcement arrived and arrested three suspects, Antonio Tolman Durain, Dakota Murphy, and Justin Jones, on charges of assault and reckless endangering.
CNN has filed a lawsuit against Donald Trump and several top White House aides for suspending Chief White House Correspondent Jim Acosta's press pass. They are seeking the immediate restoration of Acosta's access to the White House. The lawsuit comes after the White House suspended Acosta's press pass, known as a Secret Service hard pass, last week. The lawsuit argues that Acosta and CNN's First and Fifth Amendment rights are being violated. The suit was filed in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday morning. The case has been assigned to Judge Timothy J. Kelly, a Trump appointee. Both CNN and Acosta are plaintiffs in the lawsuit, and there are six defendants. CNN Worldwide President Jeff Zucker said in an internal memo to staff, quote, "This is not a step we have taken lightly, but the White House action is unprecedented."
13 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza since Saturday, when Israeli forces invaded during a botched undercover operation. One Israeli soldier was killed in the operation in which Arabic-speaking Israeli soldier dressed as Palestinian civilians attempted to infiltrate Gaza to assassinate a Hamas official. The invasion was a violation of the ceasefire reached last week between Israeli officials and the Hamas party in Gaza. After the invasion, Palestinian resistance groups fired shells into Israel, wounding five Israelis and killing one Palestinian worker who was in the Israeli town of Ashkelon. The Israeli Air Force then dropped more than 150 bombs into Gaza, targeting a television station, an apartment building, and an office building where they claimed the Hamas party had an office. On Tuesday, Egyptian mediators said they have negotiated a ceasefire, but Israeli officials maintain that they reserve the right to bomb Gaza anytime they deem necessary. This comes after 7 months of weekly nonviolent protest by Palestinians at the Gaza-Israeli border called the Great Return March. During those protests, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli sharpshooters at the border, and more than 20,000 have been wounded, 4,000 by live ammunition.
Now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus. On today's episode, UCLA Chancellor Jean Block confirms that the National Students for Justice in Palestine conference this weekend will go on as scheduled, but she fails to call out recent harassment of Muslims on campus.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. Seven Palestinians and one Israeli officer were killed Sunday during a clandestine Israeli assassination in Gaza of a senior Hamas official. Six Palestinians were killed when the Israeli Air Force fired missiles to provide cover as the Israeli special forces who carried out the mission retreated from Gaza. Al Jazeera provides a timeline of Israeli targeted killings in Gaza and beyond today, and a photo essay of Khan Yunis, the Gaza neighborhood hit by the Israeli missile strike. The raid occurred as talks on a Gaza deal were ongoing, which, according to the Washington Post, has raised new tensions. Locally, in an LA Times op-ed today, UCLA Chancellor Jean Block confirms that the National Students for Justice in Palestine conference this coming weekend at UCLA will go on as scheduled. This in spite of the Los Angeles City Council passing a resolution condemning the conference and calling for its cancellation. Block makes clear his own bias against SJP, mischaracterizes the Palestinian call for international boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, and he projects that, quote, much of what will be said at the conference may be deeply objectionable, end quote. And he furthers the, quote, fear among some that the conference will be infused with anti-Semitic rhetoric. Block also fails to mention the violence on campus last week associated with a Zionist group demonstration, leading to multiple reports of Muslim students on campus being harassed and one Muslim woman being physically assaulted. The Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council has issued an open letter in support of Students for Justice in Palestine and the conference. Meanwhile, UCLA was forced to back down from its cease and desist demand after falsely claiming that the bear on the conference logo was a trademark violation. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Black History 365 celebrates Black achievements and honors moments in Black history for each day of the year. On today's episode, in 1913, Surgeons Daniel Hill Williams was admitted as a member of the American College of Surgeons.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is November 13th. On this day in 1913, pioneering surgeon Daniel Hill Williams was admitted as a member of the American College of Surgeons. Prior to this achievement, Williams founded the Provident Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, the first non-segregated hospital in the United States in 1891. In 1893, Williams was documented as the first African-American surgeon to successfully perform a pericardium surgery.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
The advocacy group Disability Rights Oregon has called for the state to bar law enforcement officers from using police dogs in jails to intimidate, control, or punish inmates. Columbia County's jail is the only one in Oregon that continues to allow the use of police dogs against inmates. Recently, the county had to pay over $250,000 to settle a federal lawsuit after an inmate was bitten by a dog. Columbia County insurance provider agreed to settle the lawsuit filed by 48-year-old Christopher Bartlett. Bartlett claims that on August 1st of 2017, jail deputies unleashed a police dog on him after he called one of them a disparaging name. The dog bit his thigh and left arm and pulled him to the ground. The sheriff's office did not admit liability and instead said the dog was brought in to remove the inmate who was, quote, threatening and throwing and swinging things. The Columbia County grand jury that reviewed Bartlett's case in February found that using a dog could be the best way to handle a disturbance with inmates and that the dog used in the incident was properly trained. Since the incident occurred, the Columbia County Sheriff's Office has adopted a written policy that allows deputies to use police dogs if necessary to protect inmates or staff from serious injury. The legal director for Disability Rights Oregon, Emily Cooper, said in response, quote, "This practice poses an unnecessary risk of harm to both deputies and inmates when safer de-escalation strategies are available." Disability Rights Oregon now plans to push for a bill in the next legislative season that would prohibit the use of police dogs to control inmates.
Gun control advocacy group Ceasefire Oregon has asked the State House of Representatives to investigate Representative Bill Post. Representative Post is a Republican from Oregon's 25th District. Earlier this year, he posted online the phone numbers and home addresses of the chief petitioners of a ballot measure to ban assault weapons. In the March Facebook post, the representative wrote, quote, "Should anyone want to make a phone call or send a note, feel free to right-click and save the picture, then share everywhere." He then included the three petitioners' phone numbers and home addresses. Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon, Penny Okamoto, sent an email last week to House Speaker Tina Kotek and the Oregon Ethics Commission calling for the State House to create a committee to investigate Post's actions. According to Okamoto and Ceasefire Oregon, the Facebook post led to harassing emails and phone calls. In the email, Okamoto wrote, quote, "Although the information is publicly available, Representative Post's actions was clearly an attempt to harass and intimidate the chief petitioners and to undermine the ballot measure process. Representative Post's behavior is beneath the dignity of Oregon elected officials and chills political discourse."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow it will be overcast with a slight chance of rain and a high of 54 degrees. Today in history, in 1982, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial was dedicated in Washington, D.C. Designer Maya Lin won a nationwide competition to create the monument. Many groups were opposed to her design, which differed vastly from other traditional memorial statues. However, since then, the memorial has become one of the most visited monuments in Washington, D.C. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities for a decent America."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a public school in Kansas has been renamed to honor Olympian Billy Mills and Rocky Mountain Tribes joined conservation groups for a bison summit.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A public school in Lawrence, Kansas has been renamed in honor of an Oglala Lakota Olympian. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, Billy Mills Middle School celebrates the gold medalist, and the recent rededication ceremony also marked its 50th anniversary.
Billy Mills, Oglala Lakota, began his speech with a question from a student asking about the comparison of racism today and that of the past. He stated it brought him to tears, but it was a question that needed to be asked and talked about.
The racism today, we know what's caused it, which provides us the answers of how to solve it, if we're willing, and I know we are willing. Our country is on the brink. Do we develop into a full-fledged democracy and experience the sacredness that a flag portrays? Or do we withdraw and become a full-fledged autocracy? So I challenge everybody here to study, to learn, and in some way, how we can put that into our educational system and empower all of our young people.
Carol Cadu Blackwood, Kickapoo tribal member, initiated the move to change the name of the school from South Middle School to Billy Mills Middle School, and still couldn't believe it had happened.
It's overwhelming. It is. I'm still in shock. I can't believe it happened. I still have to stop myself and pinch myself because this is the first school in my research, first public school that I could find that's been a public school renamed after a Native American.
Next on Cadu Blackwood's list is she wants to push for Native American history to be taught in Kansas. As for Billy Mills, one more honor will be bestowed upon him. The University of Kansas announced Mills will be given an honorary doctorate of humane letters at their commencement in May of 2019. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
A number of tribes from the Rocky Mountain region joined bison conservation groups in Boulder, Colorado, recently for the first ever Tribal Bison Summit. Melody Edwards has more.
Eastern Shoshone member Jason Baldes was recently hired by the National Wildlife Federation to serve as the tribal buffalo coordinator. He says part of the event was a drumming ceremony celebrating National Bison Day.
The spirits were with us. You know, there were eagles flying over the top of us as well as cranes. And it was kind of an emotional and spiritual moment to kind of convene the summit in that way through ceremony.
Tribes around the Rocky Mountain region have been working for years to relocate genetically pure wild bison from Yellowstone National Park to reservations. Baldes has been instrumental in building a herd for the Eastern Shoshone in Wyoming, which is now up to 23 animals. He says at the summit, leaders discussed the challenges of getting more wild bison into the care of tribes.
We're still trying to break through this barrier of treating buffalo like cattle. And it's kind of an ingrained philosophy that buffalo are rarely considered wildlife, and so it's a paradigm shift.
Baldes says the 23 bison on his reservation have encouraged the return of many plant, reptile, and bird species to the landscape. But he says it's also meant cultural healing.
When it comes to tribal communities, it's not only about ecological restoration. It's about being proud and strong in who we are as buffalo people.
As part of that effort, Baldes says his tribe is currently working collaboratively with the Northern Arapaho to expand the fenced-in range of wild bison on the Wind River Reservation in the near future. That means obtaining more bison from the Fort Peck Reservation's quarantine program. Baldes says he's hopeful the new Yellowstone National Park Superintendent, Cam Shawley, will be supportive of that program. Shawley took over earlier this summer after his predecessor, Dan Wenk, was reassigned but chose to retire instead. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As fires blaze across California, the death toll has risen to at least 44. In addition, there are over 200 people missing and 150,000 remain displaced. There are more than 8,000 fire crews battling the wildfires that have scorched around 400 square miles of the state. Tim Abudara, a representative for the International Association of Firefighters, said the city of Paradise was, quote, literally wiped off the map. Abudara also said that at least 36 firefighters have lost their own homes, mostly in the Paradise area. He added, quote, anytime you're a firefighter and your town burns down, there are a lot of feelings and a lot of guilt and a lot of concern. Firefighters have made progress, holding containment at 25% as of Sunday, but they are bracing for gusty winds and critically dry conditions next week. The chief warned that the fire conditions will continue until the state sees rain.
An Oregon man was arrested after trying to purchase a car with a large amount of marijuana. The car was being sold online from an Albany dealership. Captain Brad Lyles of the Albany Police Department said, and quote, the dealer received a message from a potential buyer requesting to trade a substantial amount of marijuana for the vehicle. The car dealer immediately called law enforcement. An investigator then talked with the potential buyer to arrange a deal. Franks arrived to make the trade and was unexpectedly greeted by the Lynn Integrity Narcotics Enforcement Task Force. Officers seized more than 5 pounds of marijuana and jailed Franks on a charge of unlawful delivery of marijuana.
Veterans from Oregon have traveled to Washington, D.C. to urge for more public lands protections in Congress. I had this story in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Veterans from around the country, including Oregon, are in Washington, D.C. this week, advocating for bills to protect more acres of public lands. In a letter delivered to Congress on Veterans Day, former service members say public lands and rivers offer a chance to heal and reintegrate into civilian life. Rusty Lininger is founder of Source One Serenity, which provides fly fishing opportunities as healing projects for veterans in Oregon and is in D.C. He says for many veterans, being outside is a special kind of rehabilitation after being on the battlefield.
The best therapy for me is to sit on a cold, wet rock and just let the outdoors take it all, because it doesn't judge.
Oregon veterans are pushing for passage of the Frank and Jeanne Moore Wild Steelhead Special Management Area Designation Act to protect about 100,000 acres of the North Umpqua watershed and is named for a World War II veteran who lives in the area. They'd also like to see Congress pass the Oregon Wildlands Act, which would designate more than 90,000 acres as wilderness and add 250 miles of wild and scenic rivers protections. Lininger says he would like to see lawmakers from both sides of the aisle stand together to protect one of the country's most precious resources, its public lands.
We don't take care of our natural resources in this land. Then what have we got? We don't have a boat, basically. Politics and stuff, they come and go. But the land is here. If we don't protect it, then, well, might as well find another place to go.
Former service members are pushing Congress to pass 9 bills in total by the end of the year. Together, these bills would preserve 1.3 million acres as wilderness, nearly 400 miles of rivers, and more than 700,000 acres of land through other conservation designations. This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Portland Mayor Ethan Sterbling has filed the initial paperwork that will allow him to begin raising money for next year's mayoral race. The Democratic incumbent filed the campaign paperwork last Monday. Mayor Sterbling told the Portland Press Herald that he is not necessarily seeking re-election yet, but is filing the, quote, make sure everything is copacetic, as I begin exploring. The mayor said he will make a final decision on running by the end of spring. Next year's election will be just the third mayoral race in Portland history. In 2011, the city switched from a ceremonial mayor appointed annually by the city council to a popularly elected mayor who serves a four-year term. Sterbling has been mayor of Portland since 2015.
In a session on Wednesday afternoon, the Portland City Council will consider a proposal to limit plastic utensils in restaurants. Advocates of the proposal say the switch would help reduce the millions of tons of plastic that get dumped into the ocean every year. Some restaurants in Portland have already made the switch from single-use plastics, while others are considering using paper or compostable utensils. Portland city leaders say the solution includes limiting plastic utensils as well as containers, like condiment containers, jam, and coffee creamer packets. The ordinance under consideration would still make plastic containers and utensils available upon request. If it passes, the plastic utensil ban will take effect July 1st of next year.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, a teen gun reform activist takes on climate change.
Veterans from around the country, including Oregon, are in Washington, D.C. this week, advocating for bills to protect more acres of...
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As a high schooler, Faith Ward cared about climate change, but she didn't believe anyone would pay attention if she voiced her deep concerns.
You don't feel very listened to as a teenager, I think.
But when the school shooting happened in nearby Parkland, Florida, Ward watched her peers begin pushing for gun control. She was inspired to join them and helped organize a local rally.
Which led me to a whole bunch of different things, voter registration, helping out with different organization efforts.
Ward realized that she could apply the skills she was learning to climate change. So this past summer, she joined a youth campaign called Zero Hour and helped lead a climate change march through her hometown of Fort Lauderdale.
In that moment, kind of looking around and seeing all the people that were there for the cause, it also feels like they're there for you. I think it's a very gratifying and united feeling.
Today, Ward is in college, and she encourages other students who are worried about climate change to speak up and get involved, too.
I think it's important not to underestimate what you're capable of and not to underestimate your abilities and how your talents can help a cause.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
A new study into the response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010 has found that the dispersants used to fight the oil spill were not only ineffective, they actually made things worse. This report comes on the heels of the recent discovery of an ongoing spill that began in 2004 and continues to leak oil, threatening to far surpass Deepwater Horizon as the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The Deepwater Horizon spill spewed 210 million gallons of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico for 87 days, making it the largest oil spill so far in U.S. history. When the Deepwater Horizon leak began in 2010, KBOO was one of the few media outlets to raise questions and concerns about the use of the chemical dispersant Corexit. Now, those concerns have been verified. A University of Miami research team analyzed the hydrocarbons within 10 kilometers of the oil spill location. They found that substantial amounts of oil continued to surface near the response site, despite the 3,000 tons of chemical dispersants dropped in the area. This is because the depth of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill created conditions that made the dispersant ineffective and unnecessary. Now, the chemicals from the dispersant remain in the Gulf, killing off the natural bacteria that degrade and disperse oil spills, and actually making the oil that remains more toxic.
2 weeks after a deadly airline crash killed 189 people off the coast of Indonesia, new information has emerged that implicates the plane manufacturer, Boeing. The company allegedly withheld information about the potential hazards of a feature installed on the model of plane involved in the crash, a Boeing 737 MAX 8. Investigators say the airplane in question had experienced problems on its previous four flights before the crash. A new report from the Wall Street Journal implies that Boeing may be at least partly to blame. Citing safety experts involved in the investigation, the journal reported that the automated stall prevention system, which is meant to keep flight crews from pushing the plane's nose up too high, can, under certain conditions, push it down unexpectedly and so strongly that flight crews cannot pull it back up. This can result in a steep dive or crash, even if pilots are manually flying the plane and do not expect flight control computers to kick in. Boeing has not addressed the report directly, but says they are cooperating in the investigation.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 13th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell and Yasmin Kovanoglu. The producer is Yasmin Kovanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. Coming up in tomorrow's news. Coming up tomorrow morning in KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler. Look at Native American political and ethical leaderships. At 9, the radio activist welcomes members of Positive Charge. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Dirtbag talks about cold weather, fall cleanup, and dormancy plus your calls. All of these programs at KBOO are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Earlier today, the Urban League hosted a commemoration conference for the late Mulugeta Sarab. Mulugeta Sarab was murdered by a group of neo-Nazi white supremacists on this day in 1988. Sarab was a Black African-American man of Ethiopian descent. Many people categorize him as a peacemaker. And at the commemoration today, Sarab was labeled as, and quote, a man who lived his life as a peacemaker and a man who died a peacemaker. Sarab was stated as a man of joy and great honor. What other way for us here at KBOO to honor him than by sharing with all of you a piece of this morning's event? Speaking is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Portland, Nikengo Harmon Johnson, and Sarah's uncle. Please note, there may be triggering remarks given in this speech pertaining to violence. This is not a performance for entertainment. This is a speech regarding resilience, tenacity, and perseverance. Rest in power, Mulugeta.
And now, I'd like to introduce the Urban League CEO, Nikengo Harmon Johnson. Please join me in welcoming Nikengo to the stage.
Good morning.
And now, I'd like to introduce the Urban League CEO, Nikengo Harmon Johnson. Please join me in welcoming Nikengo to the stage.
Good morning. I'm going to start this morning with a smile on my face, and I'm going to do my very best to keep it throughout the day, because we are here today to celebrate the life, memory, and legacy of Mulgeta Serao. We're here to celebrate the connections between the Black and African immigrant and refugee communities here in Oregon and frankly across our region. We're here to celebrate this community that has come together today to remember, to learn, and to change. And that means a great deal to me. I took part of the weekend, though, to reflect. I took part of the weekend to feel all that it is that I am feeling during these days about what happened 30 years ago, about the murder of our brother and neighbor, and about what's happening on our city streets today that feels very familiar to me, so much like 30 years ago. And so while my face looked a little bit different over part of the weekend, because of the sadness, because of the grief, because of the intensity of the moment that I feel now, and the memories that are so very fresh in my heart, I've made a choice today to share with you a different face, a different energy, and a different feeling. And that's because I am so honored, so grateful that members of the Ethiopian community, that members of Mr. Serao's family have joined us today. I am so honored and so grateful that sponsors, supporters, corporations, individuals, elected officials have decided to stand up with us at this moment in time when so many others have chosen to cover their ears, to cover their eyes, and to be silent. I've decided to be grateful, to be excited, that we can make a change, that we can make things different because we choose to, and so many of us are choosing to do that, and your presence here today is a signal that you are with us, a signal that you are here, not just in this room, but in this moment, to stand against hate, to do what is necessary, to make this a community that reflects our values, to make this a country that we can be proud of, knowing that not just we, but all of our neighbors and friends can be safe, have a real chance to pursue the American dream. So, first, I want to say thank you to all of you for being here this morning. We will have thanks throughout the day at various times, and Jackie shared with you a number of them, but I want to thank all of you because you're taking time out of your day, you've taken money out of your wallets, and it means so very much, so thank you. Mr. President, to our host, the president of PSU, I want to say thanks. I know leading an organization that's much smaller than yours, that it can be tough to say yes to hosting an event like this. Folks, there are plenty of places who would not want us to be with them today because they'd be afraid of the violence that could come along with it, right? We know there are folks in our town and who visit from across the bridge who would be happy to tarnish a day like this, who would be happy to make us afraid, who would look forward to causing grief or strife or discord at a time like this. So that you were willing to say yes to hosting us, to welcoming us onto to your campus and into your building means a great deal. I don't take it lightly. So thank you so much to Portland State University and your leadership. At the same time, I must say thank you to Urban League President Emeritus, as I lovingly call him, Michael Alexander, who needs no introduction. Your leadership, your friendship means so much to me, not only as your successor as the CEO of the Urban League, but in your role with Portland State University and in the community. You never falter, you never wavered to stand with us when we need you. And even when we don't know you're working in our favor, I know that you are always there. So thank you, Mr. Alexander. Okay, folks, I'm really glad that Jackie welcomed and thanked our elected officials. Mayor Wheeler, you've got a lot going on these days, and it means a lot for you to take time to be with us this morning. So thank you for making time to do that. I want to recognize you for that. Jackie noted the exits in this room, and we say that somewhat jokingly, flight attendant style, but I do want to call your attention to something that's very real, and it's something that me and my staff have our attention on pretty regularly, because we are the only organization. Madam Justice, if you would, please. You're right on time. Getting ready to thank you. We are the only civil rights and social justice organization with the mission of serving Black people. We are the only one with it in our mission. There are others that serve African Americans, don't get me wrong. There are others that are African American led, but we are the only civil rights and social justice organization in the region with the explicit mission of serving Black people. So when it comes to safety and security, we always have that in our minds. Much like our friends at MET, quite frankly, we know what it means to have an open door policy and how that can put me and my staff and our
When I arrived in the U.S. from Ethiopia on a student visa in March 1973, I had no plan to remain in the U.S. My plan, here we go.
Some in the Mercury as well, to take some time. read the coverage in the Scionian who have not going to be one of those days that I want others to be heard. I want us to be together, and I want us to have plenty of time to do, to say, and to feel the things that we will do, say, and feel. I will ask those of you who have not yet read the coverage in the Oregonian, who have not yet read the coverage in the Scanner, who have not yet read the coverage in the Willamette Week or in the, there was some in the Mercury as well, to take some time and do that. Go online and get those clicks because they need to know that we care about coverage like that. I go out of my way to ignore some of the coverage that may be in our paper of record that is trash, highlighting Patriot Prayer Boys and white nationalists in glowing terms. I go out of my way to avoid a content that may be in our largest weekly newspaper that denigrates Black women. But when they get it right, let's give them a couple clicks to let them know that's the kind of content that we want to see. So thank you to the to Amy Green. I will not thank her entire outlet for her latest story over the weekend about Mogeta Sarah. I want to thank The Scanner for being the first to publish a major story about Mogeta Sarah in this community. I know The Scanner newspaper is here today. It means a great deal. I also want to call your attention to this fact. While we are celebrating Mogeta here today, we're not done. It has come to my attention, first, that there was not enough happening in our community on the occasion of this 30th anniversary to lift up his name, to lift up his memory, to celebrate who he was and also who we were as a community in that moment when we stood together, when we rallied around the Ethiopian community, when we rallied together with his friends and with his family. There was not enough going on to celebrate that in this moment, and not enough to remember that what happened 30 years ago, y'all, it's not real far away from what could happen today. And we know that because of what Jeremy Christian, the crimes, the murders that he committed on our public transportation last summer. And for me, I want to share with you why it was important to do this. We wanted to commemorate Mulgeta Sera, and we started with the idea of a commemoration. But the more I heard after Jeremy Christian committed those murders and attempted murder, from folks saying, oh, how could this happen in Portland? Not in Portland. Portland, the place of skateboards and coffee and hipsters? No, this isn't the Portland I know. Friends from around the country, right, seeing the Facebook headlines and other places were reaching out and saying, my goodness, what's going on? That's not what happens out there. That sounds more like the Deep South. So I had to remind folks to look at the FBI hate crimes list and see where Oregon falls. We don't fall, we're at the top. And we have been since I was a kid, y'all. The Klan has always felt at home in Oregon. So when I hear folks talk about this place differently than that, it's just weird to me. I love Portland. I love Oregon. I came back home to be in this place. But it's not because I forget what our past and our present is. So it's important to me that all of us be looking through the same window as we seek to confront the problems of the day, as we remember that these thugs that take over our streets every other weekend downtown, they're not to be played with. They're not to be taken lightly. They're not cute, they're not fluffy, they're not friendly, they're not just seeking to express their opinion. They are the same kind of people who 30 years ago fomented the murder of Mulgeta Sera. They're the same kinds of people, frankly, that beat, maimed, and killed others in our community whose names we don't talk about. I'll say this briefly, and I hope that many of you are attending our CLE this afternoon so that you can hear it from those who are experts. But some of you will remember Justice Thurgood Marshall, Supreme Court, right? Before he was on the Supreme Court, he was a civil rights lawyer who tried many of the cases that led up to the Brown versus Board, which was the decision that ended legal segregation in our schools and elsewhere in this country. Thurgood Marshall had a rule, though. When he was trying all those little cases that led to the big case, he would not take on a client who didn't have a sparkling clear past, who in any way had committed a crime, not so much as jaywalking, folks. He wouldn't do it because he knew if he took a black person before any jury, any judge, anywhere who had something on their record, some tick, even if they had been grievously injured in some way, the court would find a way to make a false equivalency. Well, you are not worthy of justice because you have committed a crime in your past, sir. Well, you are not worthy of equity because you have not lived up to the standard that we think folks need to meet. The reason that there are so many other names in our community that we don't remember who were harmed by these vicious racists is because they weren't pristine enough. Mulgeta Sera, however, and you will hear others tell his story better than I could, was a father, was a brother, was a nephew, was an immigrant student to our community, was a friend, was a neighbor who had done absolutely nothing wrong. People could see themselves in him. They could understand a bit about his life and his desire to catch the American dream and to make a better way for him and for his family. He, who he was easy for folks to understand and frankly very palatable. That's another reason why it's important to lift up his name, because there are so many others that he and his experience represents whose names we will never call out. So before I bring Mr. Sera's uncle to the podium, I would just like to take 15 seconds of silence to think about others in our community who have been harmed, who've been attacked, who've been threatened, who've been murdered because of their religion, because of their skin color, because of who they choose to love and how they present in this world, those people whose names are not being called out today, but who are every bit as much a part of the fabric of our community. Just 15 seconds of silence, please. Thank you. Okay, it's been said, but I really want to make sure that I call out the Urban Leaguers that are in this room and in the hallway and even back in the office. Some of you will know that we don't shut the Urban League doors. On occasions like this where it's all hands on deck, there are still people back in the office that are serving clients right now. They're at our senior center serving our elders. They are in our building helping people to get jobs. They are helping people to get housed. We are always working all the time. So in addition to the people you see here in red t-shirts, there are others back on the home front. So Urban Leaguers, those of you who are in this room and who can hear me, please share this with your colleagues. I want to say thank you, because you are the reason that this is possible. Thank you so much for your time, your effort, your energy. When there is something awful in this community, I call you the racial firefighters, because you run towards the N-word when you hear it shouted out loud. You run towards these places where these thugs would gather to scare people like us away. You wear that Urban League symbol on your chest like it's an S. And it means something. It means something to me. When the Good in the Hood parade was festival was threatened more than a year ago, and companies dropped out, and sponsors said, you can keep our money, but we're not going to come to this festival for and by black people in the black community because racists have said they might attack. The Urban League said, all right, well, I guess we got to double down. You stood up and you came out and you brought your families and your friends. You opened our buildings on a weekend to say, yeah, if something bad does happen, you can seek shelter here. You said, but we're not going to make it scary. We're going to throw a barbecue and we're going to make it fun. But I know in your hearts, in your heads, you carry the weight of what could happen, of what might happen, even as you're doing the best to prevent it. So while this is a conference, I know it's not just a conference. And I want to thank all of you for the effort that you've put into this today. Thank you, Urban Leaguers.
Journalism from Walla Walla College, now Walla Walla University, in 3 years, in 1976. After I graduated, I was offered a position as director of the Seventh-day Adventist Publishing House in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where I worked as a translator and editor before I left for the U.S. When I wrote my father to tell him the good news that I was returning home as a big shot, I did not expect his reaction. He told me not to return home at that time. He said it was not safe for me to do so. You see, in 1976, Ethiopia was in the middle of a raging civil war. People were being killed in the streets randomly, especially young men. Instead, my father told me to send for my brothers and my nephew to bring them to the U.S., where he thought they would be safer. After a few years of indecision, not knowing when I would be able to return home, it dawned on me that chances of my returning to Ethiopia were getting slimmer and slimmer. I decided to go to graduate school in the U.S. In 1979, I enrolled in the Department of Sociology at Portland State University on this very campus. It was at that time I received letters from my nephew, Mulugeta Srau, and from one of my brothers letting me know that they had graduated from high school and wanted to come to the U.S. to further their education. By then, I had met and befriended a very kind couple, Clarence and Elsie Tupper, who lived in Goldendale, Washington. They were willing to sponsor Mulugeta and my brother. I sent Mulugeta and my brother I-20s. That's International College Acceptance Letters. Mulugeta completed the process and arrived in Portland in December 1980. I cannot explain the happiness we both felt when I picked him up at the airport. We had not seen each other since Mulugeta was a small boy. I marveled at how he had grown up into a handsome young man. You see, Mulugeta and I have always had a special bond. He was the second child and the first son of my beloved older sister, Fetanej Brahanu. She was the person I loved more than anyone else because she cared for my younger siblings and me when our young mother died. Unfortunately, she died at a young age too. I felt it was my turn to help her children now. I was happy to have the opportunity to help Mulugeta. Mulugeta moved in with me in my apartment in Beaverton, and he proved to be a very responsible young man. He quickly found a job at first at a fast food restaurant, later at a small Catholic school in Beaverton. He became a favorite of both the students and the staff, the teachers. He was hardworking, caring, kind, and respectful. He also made a circle of friends among the small community of Ethiopians and Americans alike. He quickly was acknowledged as a leader and a peacemaker. He was also an avid soccer player. When I decided to move to California in January 1982 and suggested that he join me in my move, he politely declined. He said he liked it in Portland. He has his friends, his job, his school. He assured me that he could take care of himself. During the following years, Mulugeta and I, my family kept in close contact. We would attend relative weddings and other major events together. He would visit my family in California frequently during the holidays, and I would visit him in Portland occasionally. In the process, he and my young daughter established a very special bond during his frequent visit. She just loved his beautiful smile and sweet personality. The last time I saw Mulugeta was during a Labor Day weekend in 1988, a couple of months before he was murdered, when we attended a relative's wedding in Walla Walla, Washington. He was very happy and is still going to school. Then I received a phone call on that fateful Sunday morning at 5 o'clock on November 13, 1988. The voice on the other end of the line said that Mulugeta was hurt in a fight early that morning. But intuitively, I knew that something had gone terribly wrong because Mulugeta was never a fighter. He always tried to stop fights. Even when he was murdered, he was not fighting, but he was trying to stop the fight between his friends and the skinheads. This selfless act demonstrates the true nature of Mulugeta's heart, even in the face of danger. My beloved Mulugeta Srau lived as a peacemaker and died as a peacemaker. Thank you.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week.